This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. The show's hosted by Marco Arment. He's a creator, the inventor, the founder of Instapaper.com. I'm Dan Benjamin. We'd like to say thanks to today's sponsor, Sound Studio 4 from Feltip and MailChimp.com. More about them as the show goes on. Bandwidth for episode number 32 has been provided by Midas Green Technologies. Virtual private servers submerged in oil. Seriously. You can check these guys out at MidasGreenTech.com.
We got to talk about this this thing that just came out this morning. The Amazon App Store complaint from, what's it called? BitHack, and the app is called Apparatus. And they had an Android game called Apparatus in the Amazon App Store with no space.
Right.
And they basically, they said they're pulling the game from the App Store because of all these different issues that they had. The biggest ones being that there's no device filtering. And so Android devices, there's so many different kinds of Android devices with so many different capabilities that, especially for game manufacturer or for game makers, it's really tough to get everything to work right because you're dealing with different graphics hardware, different screen resolutions, different physical sizes, lots of different things. So to try to make a game run on Android with any kind of modern graphics is challenging. Just because of all the fragmentation, all the different devices you have to run on. And the official Google marketplace for apps has some kind of automatic filtering where you can specify a list of devices that you're compatible with or not compatible with, I think. I don't know which direction it goes. And it won't let people install them on or buy them on a device that doesn't support them, which is great.
Right.
The Amazon App Store doesn't do this. It lets anybody buy anything. And so there's no way it ignores the... Apparently the app specifies in a manifest file somewhere like what it's compatible with. Amazon ignores that and just lets anybody buy anything. And that's obviously a pretty big problem for support and you know, refunding and just bad reviews and everything. And so another problem is there's no way for them to respond to this horrible review they got. And this like they got a negative review on the Amazon App Store that isn't even true. It's claiming that they like talked to an ad server. And if you read it, the review is, it's like, I launched the game and it showed a black screen. So it must be talking to an ad server.
Right.
I'm waiting for it to respond. So I realized I was using an ad blocker. So I turned off the ad blocker and it still didn't work. It still launched to a black screen. And then I turned on airplane mode and it still launched to a black screen. So therefore, it must be waiting for an ad server to respond and is tracking my every move. Like, no part of that experience would have implied that. As far as I can tell from the text of this review, like, it makes no sense whatsoever that that's the conclusion you would draw from that. And yet he did, and that became, like, voted up the most helpful review. And so that's like, the top review. It was just horrible. It's, like, it's totally false. And the developer even said there's no internet connectivity for this. There's no ads. Like, there's nothing to that at all. And you know, you can't respond to that. And then the problem is, Amazon, as they do, I think with the old version of their Kindle book deal. I know the new, now that they have the agency model, I think part of the negotiations were different. But originally with Kindle books, Amazon controlled the pricing. They would not let publishers set the price. Publisher could set the wholesale price, and then Amazon could price it as whenever they want after that. And so they're doing the same thing here with the Amazon App Store No Space for Android,
right?
Which is, you as a developer can, I guess you can suggest a price. I don't even know if you can do that, but Amazon reserves the right to change your price at any time, and you just get your percentage of whatever they decided to charge. So you have no control over your price, which is horrible, I think. So in response to this bad review dropping the sales of the game, Amazon probably automatically dropped the price of the game to 99 cents, which made it even worse because then it looks like a cheap app, and then, you know, then it looks like you shouldn't respect it, and it's horrible.
I mean, it's really a strange and kind of awful situation.
Yeah, it's
for these
terrible
guys to be in. It's really bad.
And, you know, it's worth thinking about this as we get possibly closer to a rumored Amazon tablet. This is probably going to be an issue whatever they do with this tablet thing that might exist that everyone just assumes, including me, that it does exist. But I would be shocked if this was really any better in the future, because this is how Amazon tends to treat their entire supply chain. Is, you know, we set the price and, you know, screw you if it doesn't work out for you. I suspect that if Amazon does make this tablet, I suspect it's going to be a pretty nasty scene for developers like this. So anyway, that's about all I got on that.
They could. I mean, for the record, they could change this, right? They could make it a much better place. And look back at the beginning of selling apps in the iTunes store. There were issues. There's still issues, but there were certainly some issues. And even recently, issues with in-app purchases. I mean, we were just talking about that. It seems like yesterday. It was a few weeks ago. And that's changed. So this is something that, you know, Amazon has never done before. And they're clearly not learning from Apple in this situation. But they could change it.
Well, but they have done it before. They did it with the Kindle. I think this is no longer the case. But originally, that was the case with Kindle book pricing. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, who knows? You're right. They could change it. There's nothing saying they can't change it. They can change whatever they want. They're a big company with lots of resources, full of smart people. So they can do it if they want to, but it just seems like they don't want to. It seems like their model of retail is that they have as much control as possible. It's very similar to Walmart, actually, in this regard, where the retailer has a massive amount of power over its suppliers. And that's about the extent of what I know about it, so I don't want to keep rambling about stuff out of my butt. But it's probably going to be a pretty bad scene for developers. So anyway, let's talk about Google Plus a little bit.
Yeah. Have you been able to get in there and use it?
No.
I still can't get in there.
I've gotten like 5 or 6 invites already, and I've clicked on the links in them, and they always say, oh, well, we're full. We'll let you know. I put in my name, my first name, and my email address, and they're going to let me know when they have room. This is a weird thing. It's you have to balance the desire for exclusivity and for beta testing and for a slow rollout with the problems associated with turning away people who want to come in and try it. In this particular instance, like in a social network, you need a lot of people quickly. Like Instagram didn't do anything weird like this. They grew like crazy.
Yeah.
I think Instagram is the best example of a recent social network launch that grew like crazy and succeeded.
And they never, I mean, for the record, they never had any limits on who could sign up or when. You just got the app,
right,
signed up, done.
One of the reasons is that you can't really do that with an app. You can't really say, well, you can only sell 1,000 of these. And that's it. you could do day windows and stuff, but yeah, for the most part, they couldn't do that. But they didn't do that, and it was fine. It was great, actually, because it could explode naturally the way social networks tend to do when they're succeeding. Facebook got certainly some of its value when it launched from being exclusive, but I think that was a very, very small part of its value. I don't think that really drove its perception very well. I don't think it was a huge benefit to them to be exclusive. I think they were just doing a slow rollout because they wanted to focus on it and they needed to. But in this case, this is a very, very mature and crowded market that Google is entering. And certainly they have a lot of power because they have all the people using Google Apps, and they can shove that notification into the bar on top of all the Google Apps. So they can really like beat people over the head with Google Plus when they want people to use it, and from what I can gather from what people are saying, they do. once you use it, you're getting notifications for everything in that bar, like every little action that happens. And you can customize it, of course, but like the default is it annoys the crap out of you with a big red number every time anything happens, and the idea then is to draw you back in so that if you try it once, you don't just forget about it forever. You keep going back. And they need that to happen. But by doing this invitation only thing, and by keeping it so what do the invitations actually do?
Yeah, if you can't actually act on one, right, what's the difference from just going to the site, typing in your name, and just sitting in line?
Right. Like, is the invitation just a link to the site?
Because in the past, the way it would work, like, let's say back in the day, let's pick Google Voice as an example. You couldn't just go up to Google Voice and sign up. And wasn't it something else?
Gmail is a great example.
Yeah, Gmail is a better example. So you would have to get an invite. Well, what somebody using Gmail would have to invite you. So if I had it and I wanted to invite you, I would do that. You would get the invite. I would have a limited number of invites to give out. I might only have one or three. I might only get one every few months or something. Then I would invite you. You'd click it instantly. You're signed up. You're in. You're using Gmail. And the way they would limit it is they would limit the number of invites that they gave out, and they would limit that limited number further by only giving it to certain people. And I had the suspicion at the time that it was the people who are heavy Gmail users or the right kind of Gmail users that seemed to get more invitations than other people.
Right.
But it was instantaneous. As soon as the Gmail invite was received, you clicked it, you were in. Pick your name.
And so the difference here – the difference first is that the invitations don't always work, which is a pretty big difference, which is more like send a link to your friends, tell them about the site, and that's it. But the other big difference here is that Gmail is useful to you even if you're the only person who ever uses it, like the Bill Gates frying pan quote. Like, Gmail is great as a tool, as a standalone tool. You don't need all your friends to use Gmail to get a lot of value out of it. And similarly, you can go to Gmail and it doesn't have to be popular, and you can be great. But if you go to a social network and you can't invite some of your friends to it or all of your friends to it, or you go to it saying, oh, I don't really need another social network, but I'm going to check this thing out, then you're turned away. Why would you ever go back? Why would you ever check it out again after that? Now, again, Google does have an advantage in that they can beat people over the head with it on other Google properties, but there are people who don't use Gmail. You know, there are people who don't live in Google properties. They might use search, and that's it. So this tool they can use to wedge people into it is limited in its reach. And they need these invitations. They need someone who hears about Google Plus. If for some reason they can remember the name Google Plus, and then they can figure out how the heck to type it, whether it's the plus sign or the word plus. And then they can find it in the interface because the plus sign is kind of small relative to other characters. Assuming they can get past all these barriers, if they want to go check out this thing they just heard about, and then they're turned away, why would they remember to go check it out again in the future?
Then do they get an email that says, please come back? We're sorry.
How often do you fill those out?
Yeah.
Like, when someone tells me about like a new site that's about to launch and you go to the site and it's just some teaser page with no information and like an email box, put in your email and we'll tell you what we're going to do when we're ready for it. Like, I never – do you ever do that? I never fill those in.
No, I don't like – I don't like to.
Like, because I don't
– And this is the thing. Why make people wait? Why make you wait? Google has the infrastructure. And I was talking to John Siracusa on Hypercritical last week, and he was saying that even with all the new people that are signing up and how busy it is, he said it never felt slow. And he said, of course, yeah, there's some things that are happening client side, but it never felt slow. It never was sluggish. You didn't have to wait for pages to load. It was just snappy, the way you would expect a Google product to be. But Google has so much infrastructure and so many resources, and arguably as much or maybe more experience than almost anybody else scaling stuff. So they could probably invite the whole world and they would be just fine. You would think, right? You would expect that. You would think, well, they're Google, of course. Well, why are they blocking you?
And I've gotten about scaling. It's probably about reserving the right to make major changes still, like to mess around with the interface, to change the way certain behaviors work, change the way, you know, certain things are done, maybe change certain privacy settings, like. This, it seems like it's, you know, Google, obviously, yeah, they have all the infrastructure they can use. So I would imagine it's more of a just product decision making beta, really. Funny that they aren't using the word beta anywhere, by the way.
Maybe they feel that it's a fully baked software.
Well, they use some other. I think they're calling it a field test. They're using some other phrase that sounds a lot like beta, but isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Then they use plus, which is the geekiest thing they could have done. But and I don't know. Have you looked at the HTML of Google Plus pages?
I actually did look at a little bit because there was an article that came out from one of the, I guess he was the guy that used to be at Apple. Gosh, I wish I'd saved this link. I think he used to be at Apple and he came over to Google and he was responsible for some of the interface design at Google Plus, which is pretty good and very good. In some cases, and he—I guess he was receiving all the credit.
This is the Andy Hertzfeldt article.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah, I think right.
Yeah, I think that's who it is. And he basically said, you know, I'm receiving too much credit. That's the way it works. But I'm going to use this amazing tool that I helped build to share the credit with the people who really deserve it. In addition to me, there were these other people, and he went on to describe them. And he talked to, and I, at that point, I said, oh, let me look behind it. And yeah, I mean, what do you think of it? Do you like it?
Well, the reason that post was widely linked to by a lot of influential geek people like us, and so people wanted to save it to Instapaper, and it saved horribly. It just saved like a big list of names because there's some text element somewhere that has a big list of names on the page. The problem is the entire HTML of any Google Plus page, as far as I can see, is generated by JavaScript. It's not in the fetched source of the page.
Right.
So that's one problem. So if you just crawl the page like from curl or any kind of like command line library that's not a browser, you will not get any useful data from that page. The other problem is that if you do what my bookmarklet does and save the HTML contents of the page as being viewed, so at least then you get around JavaScript and things like that, look at the HTML sometime. It the class names they use and the structure they use is crazy. It's very obviously it's the compiled output of some kind of higher level language they're using here, or higher level framework they're using. So the class names are like random garbage, and there's tons and tons of divs everywhere with these odd class names and very deep structures of blocks and almost no useful IDs of any sort to figure out what the page is doing with this markup.
But I mean,
it's very obvious. It's like bytecode. It's very obviously a compiler's output.
It is, but that's pretty good. That's pretty impressive. They're really working to optimize this. They really want it to be They're not building it for people to read. They're building it for it to be really efficient.
So here's my question, because you've done a lot with web design and web standards and best practices, and you also hang out with more people who do this sort of thing. Do you think it breaks the web? And I put break in air quotes there. Do you think it breaks anything about the web if markup is no longer meaningfully named and labeled?
That's a great question.
Or meaningfully structured in the HTML elements. Like in this case, it's just a massive pile of divs.
Yeah.
There's really nothing else to it. It's a massive pile of divs with random garbage-generated class names that you can't tell what they're supposed to be. You know, is that bad for the web somehow?
That's a great question. I think there's the one camp the developer camp that would say, well, if you think of it in terms of it being, let's think of it as a web app. You know, if you were building a content management system or a web app or a back end or something, who cares? As long as it looks fine and works in the browsers it needs to work in, who cares about this stuff behind the scenes? Technically, I mean, you still should care. But I'm going down this path.
Right, like it works, so why?
It works, so why? And you could almost say that's okay if it's like an internal or behind the scenes or app or something that's not going to get indexed, not going to get out there. But then you have the flip side of that, which is this is actually an open. You don't need an account to be able to see the content that's being put out there on Google Plus across the board. This is something that's externally facing. So you say, well, it's breaking, but it's breaking in what sense? Can search engines find it? Well, of course, it's Google, so of course it knows how to index this.
Google
right?
can find it.
Google can find it.
We'll see how well Bing does.
Yeah, and maybe that's part of it. Maybe they're saying, we don't care if we break the web. We can get to this data, and you're using our services anyway, so who cares about the other people that want to do so? Forget micro formats or Bing or any other access to this. We'll just, you know, Instapaper. Screw Instapaper. We don't care about them.
I figured it out, but it was a pain.
Right, but I mean, you had to do this. This became work for you.
Certainly, yeah.
And if they had followed those standards, like you would expect them to or want them to, then you wouldn't have had to do any work. It would have just seamlessly integrated the way everything else should. That's a great question. What do you think?
I really don't know what I think about this. Like it's, I'm kind of on the fence. You know, it's the programmer in me says this is great. They've obviously moved up the stack, and they're using a higher level language of some sort to generate this. This is just their bytecode output, effectively, and that's really cool. But I'm sure it's allowing them to be more efficient. That's probably why they're doing it. They're being more efficient. They're having fewer errors and fewer weird bugs. So it's probably awesome. Like the reasons why they're doing it, and we're probably all better off if they're doing it this way, so that you know at least then they can make this product faster. They can make it better. They can generally speaking, like when developers can make things more easily and more cheaply that are more reliable, it's better for everybody. So there's that side of it. The other issue to think about, though, is that there's two. There's accessibility, which people in the chat room are talking about. It looks like they're using accessibility-related labels on things. There's the ARIA stuff, I believe. I don't know anything about it, so I really don't want to speak about it. But they have a lot of ARIA labels all over everything. So I'm guessing they are considering accessibility somewhat properly for that. But the other side of it is the way most of us learn all of these new technologies in web page rendering specifically is often by looking at other people's source code. The web is, you know, you could never look at, for the most part, you could never look at the source code to desktop apps.
Right.
So if you saw a desktop app doing something cool, like, oh, how do they make a button look like that? In a desktop app, you're kind of screwed. You can't really look at it and you don't really know. But if you're a web developer and you see on a web page, oh, how did they make the CSS do that? You can just go look. And you can see for yourself how they made it do that.
Some people would say that's a great thing. Other people would say that's a bad thing.
I would say the web is – I think you can use the web a lot like people use the market to argue about economic policy. I think you can see like the web has been a massive success in almost every possible way. And so I think you can look at what – you can look at the way things are done on the web and you can generally say that was probably a good idea. Or, yeah, I guess that way does work pretty well. So, you know, in this case, when you're talking about like, you know, looking at HTML, looking at CSS, these are really big technologies. Like, it's very hard to get started from nothing here. Most of us who are, you know, old enough to give a crap about this podcast, most of us probably grew up with HTML. And so we kind of grew up with it. Like as it grew up, we grew up with it. And so if you started learning HTML and related technologies like for making web pages and web apps, if you started learning those in the 90s, you're probably fine now because you could learn slowly because only a certain amount of new stuff happened every year. And especially back then, it was a lot slower. So it was really easy. If you started with HTML back, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, it was really, really easy to keep up and to have a pretty good idea of what's going on and what you can do and what you can't do and how to do certain things as they came about. And it's similar to like SQL and like some of the scripting languages that people used to make web apps. Like as all these things developed, you could kind of keep up. But if you were starting from nothing, if you were, let's say, like a high school student today wanting to get into web page development, it's really hard to say you should start here. You should start with X. You should learn X. How do you know where to start? It's so massive now. Because now to make a web page that does anything useful, you have to know like six different languages and all these different weird syntaxes and markup structures and all these different concepts. It's a lot more complicated now to start out.
Right.
And so anything we can do to make it easier to start out as an industry is better for everyone, I think.
And shouldn't Google, companies like Google, be setting this great example?
Yeah. So first of all, I would say I'd love to see what tool they're using to generate this. You know, Facebook's been pretty good about open sourcing a lot of their stuff. I'm really curious to see, are we ever going to see the result of this tool? I mean, I assume it isn't something that's already public. I could be wrong about that, but
maybe it's just one guy who just types this way. No, I doubt we'll ever see it. We'll never see it.
One of the big problems I had with it, with Instapaper's parsing, is because I guess this could be a problem with anything, but so Instapaper's parser has a pretty decent automatic mode, but it's also pretty conservative. It does not strip anything out of a page that it isn't pretty confident is unnecessary. Because the worst, like, if you have a text parser trying to strip out or trying to keep only the body text, the error case of cutting out legitimate text is much, much worse than leaving in illegitimate junk, basically. Like, if you leave in an extra navigation header somewhere or a bolded list that's full of links that's not actually part of the article, people will scroll past it. They don't care. But if you cut out the last paragraph of the article, that's a much bigger deal.
Yeah.
So I have this automatic mode that's pretty conservative. And then I have a method to customize the parser for individual sites. So if I want to fine tune something or make a certain well done site perfect, a highly trafficked site like New York Times, I make sure they have really good parsing for the most part. So I have special cases that I do here. Actually, by the way, I was going to say I shouldn't say this because competitors might copy me, but competitors copy me anyway.
You're giving them a head start.
I want to actually, if possible, I'd love to hire a contractor to do my top 100 sites and just always keep the profiles for them maintained so they're always perfect.
Mm.
I don't know how to even define somebody to do that for me, but who knows? Anyway.
Do you want them to email you?
Yeah, sure. Email me. You will never, ever hear me say email me again after this. I would never solicit more email under normal circumstances. And so when I'm making these profiles, usually I can look at the structure of a page and I can see, okay, well, this is, div ID article body. That's pretty obvious. I can probably count on that. But if you look at the Google page, not only are the class names fairly random and meaningless, but when they don't have meaningful names, when they're the output of a compiler, depending on them staying the same or meaning the same thing tomorrow would be kind of like depending on a memory address being the same function in a different version of a program. Like if Google changes anything about their layout, which it's a web app, they're going to do that all the time, all those class names could change because they're all just relative to each other, and to their CSS declaration somewhere. So if I say, well, today the article is div AU, T75, that might not be the same div name tomorrow. And so I can't depend.
Oh, you can depend that it won't be for very long. Yeah,
exactly.
That's a great point.
So the way I built that parser then, you can see if you go to instapaper.com/bodytext, you can see all my custom parsers. It's public and it's kind of open in the sense that anybody can submit them. And anyone can look at them. So what I do with that is I try to find the very, very few that have good names. There's a handful of ID names that make sense on the page, content area or something like that. I'll find those and then I'll just do relative paths from there in a fairly conservative way so that it will tolerate changes in structure and changes in class names in all the other crap, But it's still a really tough problem. And obviously this is a very special case. So I wouldn't argue that Google should or shouldn't do anything for my benefit. That would be ridiculous. But there are a lot of cases on the web where people are building cool tools like this where if the markup doesn't make sense, if it's not well-structured, you can't do stuff like this. Accessibility is a major area of that, but I think it even goes beyond that because I'm sure Google will be okay with accessibility because they care to do things technically right.
Right.
So I'm sure they'll cover that if it isn't covered already. The bigger issue is all the smaller tools that have made the web awesome can't really use this page at all. Even if they get past the issue of it all being generated by JavaScript in the first place, which is crazy. So even you get past not being able to crawl the page outside of a JavaScript interpreter, which is a pretty big thing to get past for a lot of situations. Even then, once you have the markup, if you can't really do anything useful with it, that's going to prevent a lot of tools from being effective or from even being practical.
So even if it doesn't break the web from the semantic standpoint, if it breaks it from the point of other services being able to usefully access that information, then you're intentionally building a wall, it seems.
Right. So combine that with the problems in education and learning about these things, and I think overall then, I think this is a bad thing. I think overall this kind of weird compiled output is probably a bad thing. One thing that could make it better is if they did release this, and if this was a whatever they used to write this code, if that was a public thing, that would help out in different ways. You know, it would still have a lot of these problems, but it would help out kind of in different ways. But yeah, for the most part, I think this is overall kind of a negative. Although, if I had to change something about it, I think generating it all by JavaScript, I think is the worst offense. You know, it's funny though. That's going to require search engines to competing search engines, not Google. It's going to require them to all use JavaScript interpreters.
Yeah,
which is a pretty big barrier.
That's going to be a problem.
I don't know how many. I mean, the handful of very large ones probably already do, but that's still a pretty big barrier.
Well, and it's an ill-advised thing too, because people could do pretty malicious things with put a little bomb in their JavaScript and mess with people.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, there's all these different costs to what they're doing that they're probably not going to really negatively affect Google, but they're not that great for a lot of other people. But anyway, that's probably about it on that. Want to do a sponsor?
Yeah, we can do a sponsor, sure.
We love sponsors.
We do love sponsors. Well, we need them. They make the show happen. And actually, today is one of Marco's favorite sponsors. It's Sound Studio 4. You like those guys.
Oh, yeah.
This is an easy-to-use Mac application for recording and editing digital audio on your computer. It's that simple. You can. This is what Marco used it for, I know. He has these old tapes and vinyl records, and he wants to listen to them on his computer, right?
So
this is what you use it for pretty much all the time. But you can also record live performances. You can create your own mixes with crossfades. You can tweak the levels, EQ, digital effects. And it saves in all of the major file formats, everything that you want. I typically use AIF, but it'll do WAV. It'll do MPEG-4, AAC, Ogg Vorbis. Can export as MP3, whatever you want. It's been the Mac's most popular audio program for many, many years, and these guys continue to update it, add new features, and take advantage of the latest Apple technologies. It's a 64-bit app now, for example, and it's great. So you'll find Sound Studio 4 at felttip.com/SS for Sound Studio, or you can just go to the Mac App Store, search for Sound Studio, and you will find it, and you will download it, and you will use it, and you will love it. So thanks to those guys.
Awesome.
Good sponsor.
Oh, yeah. So I found a really cool little tool. I tweeted about it the other day, and a bunch of developers said, oh, my God, thank you so much. So I gather that my enthusiasm for it is shared more widely.
I missed this. I didn't see you say this.
It's called the UIKit Artwork Extractor, and it's by a guy whose username is in hex, O-X-C-E-D. I'll link to it in the show notes. But yeah, it's called the UIKit Artwork Extractor. And you run it in the iPhone simulator, and it basically gives you a giant table view list of all of the UIKit artwork it can find, all the UIKit PNG files for all the different button graphics and everything else. And then you can hit a button and you can save them as files to your desktop, which is awesome.
That's very handy.
And so if you want to do things like get the actions menu, that little arrow coming out of the square, the actions menu icon and for iOS toolbar icons, if you want to get that as a PNG with proper transparency and everything, you can get it. You can get the actual file saved to your desktop. It's so incredibly convenient, and I'll tell you why. And that's our next big topic.
Ooh.
I'm getting more organized like Syracuse. It feels great. No, it doesn't.
I was going to say the oppressive, obsessive, compulsive behaviors of John Syracuse should not be emulated by any of our listening audience.
That's a big disclaimer.
This public service announcement has been brought to you by the SyracuseSaidSo.com website.
By the way, I got to say, I don't know if I told you last week, I got the best thank you card for the toaster. It's the best card I've ever seen. Like, John.
Oh, from John?
Yeah. John and his wife really added themselves here.
What is it? Is it like one of the big cards with Snoopy on it that plays music and has a pop-out Woodstock out of the middle?
No, like, they made the card.
They made
it? And it's three-dimensional. Like, there's like a popped-out toaster on the front. It's amazing.
Do you feel comfortable sharing it in pictures?
Yeah, I think I should.
That'd be great.
Yeah, probably not the inside because that might be personal.
Yeah, sure.
But I'll definitely take a picture of the front because it's awesome.
Only if you think it'd be cool.
Oh, yeah. I should do that. All right. So anyway, so the reason I would need a tool to extract UIKit art, this I think is interesting. So Apple would probably say you should never need this. And by the way, I have no idea whether it's allowed to use.
I was going
to
ask you.
So that's a different issue. Let me tell you why I would use something like this. And then we'll talk about whether it might be allowed and why or why not. In theory, you would never need this because you should be using UIKit the way it's intended, and it should solve all your needs magically, and it should always be the right idea to use UIKit, and that should be that. In practice, that's not the case. In practice, I run into walls in UIKit all the time because every app is going to be different. Every app has different needs. Once you start pushing the boundaries of interface design and capabilities, you're going to hit a wall pretty quickly in UIKit. And every major version of iOS, they remove a lot of those walls. Like iOS 5 removed tons of them as far as I can tell so far. Like every version of iOS that comes out, whenever I can raise my minimum required version, which is one of the reasons I keep wanting to do this, I can usually delete tons of horrible hacks I've been doing because there is now an official way to do something I was doing manually and badly before. One of the best examples is like with when OS 3 came out, I was doing tons of random horrible things in OS 2 to get like the navigation animation to fake properly when I was doing a navigation controller and things like that. So I could delete tons of code and I was thrilled. But there's still always going to be walls. You're always going to hit limitations in what UIKit can do or what it lets you do. Like one of the biggest ones that I ran into recently is in the UI search controller. Or search results controller. I forget the name. The search bar controller. You can't, at least in OS 4, I haven't even looked in 5 yet, but you can't change the colors of that field, of the text field properly. And if you change it there, if you kind of manually try to change it there, then the scope buttons don't change. And there's all these little issues with it.
Right.
And so if you want to get around that, you have to either resort to really bad hacking, like diving into the subviews and trying to set properties manually, which you, in most cases, would very quickly run into private methods that you then can't use in an App Store app. Or you have to build the whole thing from scratch yourself. Like, don't even use that component. Fake it. Make your own that hopefully behaves kind of like Apple's. And that's much harder as well, because then you have to duplicate all the Apple behaviors, which you probably won't do properly, because there's just so much there and you know, it's easy to miss something. And then you're duplicating lots of effort, and there's lots of reasons why you shouldn't do that as well. So, but the fact is there's a lot of times when you need to do something a little bit special. Like if you're making a button somewhere, like the built-in button classes are pretty thin. For the most part, they expect you to use your own graphics and do your own behaviors properly because, you know, they don't want to give you too much to use there. So I run into this all the time. I always have to recreate something manually from UIKit. And in the next major version of Instapaper, I have created a whole, how much do I want to say? I've
secrets.
Created a replacement to a major UI component for the iPad app. And I've had to duplicate a lot of Apple's functionality in it to replace to replicate functionality in what I'm replacing. And there have been so many times when it's like, oh, I need that graphic from the Apple component so I can stick it into my component. And it's and even a more general version of this, the newspaper reading screen, it has the actions icon on the top. It has the trash icon on the top. It has this row of buttons on the top of it that are not a toolbar. They kind of look like a toolbar, and they behave like a toolbar. And they're logically, it is a toolbar, but technically it's not. It's not a UI toolbar instance. And there's lots of reasons for that. I think on the iPad, this is much, much more common than on the iPhone. Because, like, on the iPhone, there's so little screen space that, for the most part, you don't need to stray much from UIKit.
Right.
Because you're not really seeing a lot of it. Most of the iPhone's UIKit stuff is invisible. It's things like navigation and structural constructs that you don't even see the interface to. And the buttons are pretty basic. The toolbars are pretty basic. It's fine. But if you take UIKit standard elements and stick them on the iPad, without a lot of modification, they usually look bad. Because the iPad is such a bigger, more flexible medium. And I think one of the reasons, I think Apple kind of kept UIKit the way it was for the most part on iPad, moving from iPhone to iPad, just because they kind of needed to, maybe for compatibility they wanted to, or for standards, or for whatever else. But like, look at how many popular iPad apps that you would consider well-designed. How many of them use UI Toolbar? Or UI Navigation Controller, even? Like, major components that every iPhone app uses.
Yeah.
It's very, very rare to find them unadulterated, at least, in iPad interfaces. So in this particular case, for my toolbar on the iPhone app or on the iPad app, I just had to somehow construct my own actions arrow and my own trash delete arrow, even though I made them look just like Apple's. I had to make them manually because I didn't have access to Apple's source files, or at least I didn't know how to get to them.
Right.
And so in a case like that, I don't think Apple's going to have a problem with it. I mean, I've been shipping that for a while, and they haven't had a problem with it.
Well, but if they listen, now they will.
It wasn't their original icons. It was me recreating their icons. I mean, it's pretty much a copy. But so I don't think they would have a problem with that kind of use. Even simple things like the little disclosure triangle on table cells. When there's like a next cell in the hierarchy,
right.
There's a little right-pointing disclosure triangle. There have been plenty of times when, like, even like making a web page or so, like, or making a UI web view fake itself to be like a web or to be like a table view, something like that. Like, there's been so many times when I've needed little graphics like that, or like the little eye with the circle, or, you know, things like that.
Yeah,
so many little things throughout the course of my iOS development career so far. Like, I so often need small originals of Apple graphics, like little things like that. And so this is a very useful thing, and I think it's definitely worth considering for iPad usage when you're building iPad interfaces. Do you really need UIKit stuff, or do you need to use it as it's intended? Like UI Toolbar, I mean, what do you think? I think this UI Toolbar is so ugly on iPad, and like the navigation controller, like Apple says in the iPad HIG, they've always said like try to avoid a lot of full screen transitions. So like the navigation controller where everything kind of slides off to the left and you push a new thing on the stack and you hit back and everything slides back to the right. Like Apple says, try to avoid that on the iPad because it's such a big expanse of this canvas that a huge full screen transition is very jarring to the user and is probably not necessary. Like you can probably just flatten that hierarchy out and use fewer transitions. So anyway, there's even by Apple's own guidelines, there's often cases where you should stray from UIKit. And Apple does all the time, by the way. I mean, you look at all of Apple's apps and you can find like the little actions button is all over the place and things like that. Like they take elements out of their popular UIKit components and use them all over the place in ways that developers easily can't. But
isn't this just Apple's privilege? Apple's privilege to do things differently, to do things whatever they want. And if you want to emulate that functionality, good luck. Figure it out. Do it yourself. Do it the hard way.
It is Apple's privilege, but they're also setting the example and they're setting the precedent. They're saying, look, you can have an actions swoop arrow icon somewhere that's not a toolbar, and that's okay. You know, as long as it's an area where people would expect to find it, or like, you know, as long as it makes sense in your context, then you can use it. Like, I think that's the precedent Apple sets is, here's our guidelines, but if you are good, if you have the right sensibilities, you can choose when to break them or when to stray from them slightly. So, I don't know. I think that's it.
Well, it's,
you got anything else on that topic?
Well, no, I mean, it's another one of these situations where when you consider what Apple wants you to do, the fact that you said that you've essentially done that, for all intents and purposes, you've done this and we're not penalized for it. Do you think that that's because, yeah, we've talked about this in the past when we've talked about app submission process. Do you think that maybe Apple just, their automatic, whatever their software is that looks at an app to check and see if you're doing things that they don't want you to be doing, you know, that perhaps this is something that they're not looking for and that visually it's not something that people can detect just by looking right at it, that you've done something that maybe Apple would consider wrong? Do you expect this will show up in their guidelines soon?
I guess I'll find out. I don't know. I think part of your question is an assumption that this is wrong, that they wouldn't allow this, and I think that's not necessarily correct. I mean, if you look back in the old Visual Basic days, I first used Visual Basic 1.0, and then I used 3.0, and then I stopped using it. But back then, Visual Basic came with this massive set of icons, and the idea was, here's a bunch of icons you can use in your apps, and you, as far as I know, they were like totally restriction free, no royalties, no licensing restrictions. You could do whatever you wanted to these icons, however you wanted to use them. And it's very possible that Apple considers UIKit's basic elements to be that kind of tool set, to be like, well, here, you can use these however you need to use them in your app. These are the standards on the platform.
Right.
You know, we're not going to tell you that you have to use this one particular icon that's a universal system icon, that you have to use it in this particular UI component. It's very possible they think that way. I hope so. That'd be great. Normally, they're pretty reasonable about stuff like this. And so I would assume that's probably their thought process on this. Where they need to be more restrictive is with trademarks. But I don't think they consider any of these really meaningful trademarks that they want to enforce. Like, they care a lot if one of your icons depicts an iPhone. They really care a lot about that.
That's a big one. But that's their their device,
that's
their image.
The iPhone's trademark.
Right.
Right. Like the trademark depiction of their product. They really care about that. They care a lot if you mention Steve Jobs in your app description. They really care a lot about that. And or really any celebrity for that matter. If you mention any kind of celebrity, but especially Steve Jobs, anywhere in the app or description, you will almost definitely get rejected for that, because again, there's legal concerns there, there's political concerns there. So those all make sense. Like, it's easy to be defensible on those restrictions and say, okay, well, there's good reasons Apple shouldn't allow those. But like the basic UI elements and icons and stuff, I don't think they care that much, and I don't think they need to care that much. I think if you're using an icon the way it's meant to be used logically. So like if I use the action arrow icon to pop up a popover with actions on it, I think that's okay. Even if it's not in a UI toolbar.
Mm.
If I use the action icon to instantly delete whatever you're viewing with not showing a menu, then that's a problem, because that's like expected behavior is not being used. And they actually have rules against that in their documents. Like that is a documented rule. Like you have to, if you're going to use a system component, you have to use it the way that it's normally used, like conceptually. Like I've heard of apps getting rejected for using the update arrow, the refresh arrow, the kind of circular arrow for like get new mail and stuff. I've heard of apps getting rejected for using that in using that to perform an action that wasn't an update of content or like fetching new things. That's just that's a whole separate guideline. But as far as I know, if you take that arrow and you stick it on a fake toolbar that's really just a UI view, I don't think they're going to care. So far, at least they haven't cared, as far as I can tell. So yeah, I'll let you know if that ever changes. I will certainly be probably loud about it if that does change, but we'll see. I think I'll be okay.
Do you think we have time to talk about this laptop situation, or should we save that for the next?
I think we do. I think this is good. And then we'll call it a day after that.
You sure?
Yeah, let's do it.
You don't have anything else on the list you want to do?
Nothing timely.
All right, well, before we do that, let's thank our second sponsor. It's MailChimp.com. Love these guys. Love these guys. I don't know how to... Can I say that enough? Do I say that enough? I use MailChimp.
No, you don't.
I use MailChimp. I love MailChimp. They do a lot for 5x5 too, and they'll do a lot for you if you sign up. They make it really easy to design email newsletters. That is their one goal. But now they have a whole bunch of new features, really easy integration with sharing them on social networks, integrating with, you know, the web services that you already use. I don't know if they're doing anything with Google Plus, but I bet they will. You can use your own HTML and CSS and make it as impossible to read as you want, or you can follow the web standards like we were talking about earlier and use these amazing templates that they've already created that famous people and famous designers have contributed. You can just check that out. These cool integrations they have, Social Pro is what I was talking about before, but they've got Google Analytics integration. They've got autoresponders that you can integrate with your iOS app, like I've told you about with ChimpKit and all of these other things. Even it doesn't matter, Android, iOS, whatever you want to integrate with, you can do it. And it's all free, 12,000 emails a month, 2,000 subscribers free. Go to MailChimp.com, check them out, and in doing so, you will be showing your support for this show as well. So here's the situation we're talking about. This is a laptop thing. So for those who don't know, I'm in a closet right now. Not figuratively, literally in a closet, actually in a closet.
Well, I'd support you either way.
Well, thank you. And this is because we're now in our second small temporary rental house, which they call a vacation house, although I'm not on a vacation. That's what they call it. While we are now on our second house that we're buying, the first one didn't happen. We're now on a second one. It's a long story. I don't want to get into it. But the second one is actually much better than the first one that we tried to buy. But it doesn't close for another few weeks. So we had to move from one temporary rental house into another temporary rental house. So I'm in this closet. And, you know, spending a lot of time sitting in a closet, you start to think about portable computers and things like that. And in the new house, one of the things that I've wanted to do for years and years, I've been working and living in the same place, just like you do right now out there in Brooklyn. You live and work in the same place. And it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. But as 5x5 has grown and as my family has grown, it's been harder to have those two things together. And you can shut the door and pretty much, you know, you have that isolation. But if you're recording, especially if you want people to be in the studio, you won't want people coming into your house, all that mess. So I'm getting out of there. I'm getting some studio space here in Austin. And getting out and going to that studio space makes me really consider what kind of machines I'm going to want to have at home versus which ones I'm going to want to have portable. So not long ago, prior to the start of this move, I got a MacBook Pro. It's a 15-inch. It's a high-res anti-glare screen. Absolutely love this machine. This is my main machine. I plan on keeping it as my main machine. But I don't want to have a whole ton of machines at the house like I've always had in the past. It was always a byproduct of working, of having an office, right? You have an office at home, you're going to have your machines at home. So right. I've had Mac Pros, Mac Minis, iMacs, tons and tons and tons of machines. So many machines. We don't want that anymore. I want to be done with that. I'm still going to have a little study in the new house, but I don't want it junked up with tons of computers. My goal is I don't even want screens there. I just want to have a place where whether it's me or my wife or whoever, we can sit down, we can use that as an office. It keeps one of the rooms free for a guest room, that kind of thing. So this machine, this 15-inch MacBook Pro is going to be the main machine, but it's not just going to be mine, really. It's going to have all the stuff on it that we would want, whether it's family photos, music libraries, you name it. It's going to be the main machine. I don't want to have an iMac or Mac Pro or whatever sitting around anymore. It'll be mobile within the house, but I'm not sure that I want this machine to be the machine that I take with me to the studio every single day, or the machine that I sit in a, you know, on when we do the community stuff on Fridays, that's the machine that I want to be with me there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, it's family kind of a tricky situation. Yeah. I mean, and this is, by the way, I think this ties in very well with John Siracusa's No iLife is an Island thing. Because Apple still does a very poor job of having like family computer situations in general. But yeah, it makes sense. I think what you're saying makes sense, is that if that's going to be the computer that your family and your household are going to depend on, then you can't bring it with you to work.
I can't have it gone with me every day, all the time, and that kind of thing. So I've been thinking. I mean, I could, and it's, you know, it's not like my wife doesn't have her own, 13-inch MacBook Pro. She does, and there's a lot of things you could do with that. But having one machine that's sort of centralized, that's the place to sync up everything and runs everything, connected to everything, and yeah, it's a laptop computer, it's a mobile computer, and what that simply means is that we can use it wherever we want within the house. And yeah, if we want to take it somewhere, we could. If we needed to take it somewhere, we could. We're not tethered to anything. But at the same time, I don't know that that's the computer that I want to have with me. So now I'm looking at this MacBook Air, this new one that's coming out. Now we know that the new ones are coming out. We don't know the exact day. The rumor that stands right now, and we should frame this. Today is July 5th. It's Tuesday, right? 2011. The rumors that we've heard have been that the new MacBook Airs will come out, be released with Lion on them at the same time that Lion is released, and that, no, it's not going to be at the very, very last day possible of July, that, in fact, it might come out on the 12th, I've heard. I've heard the 14th. I've heard the 19th. This is very timely for me. And that the new ones, the new MacBook Airs, they may have this faster flash in the, you know, storage in them. They may have a Thunderbolt, but it doesn't matter. It'll be a good, whatever they are. That's what I'm thinking about getting.
The big difference is going to be the CPU upgrade. If they move to the Sandy Bridge architecture.
Yeah.
I think the most credible rumor I heard was somewhere around a 1.8 gigahertz low voltage Sandy Bridge part. That would be awesome.
Yes, that would be crazy.
That's a huge CPU. Because I have a 13-inch Air in the current model. I maxed it out. I have the 2.13 gigahertz Core 2 Duo and all the RAM and the
pimped out version.
It's great, except the CPU performance is really terrible.
Hmm.
And there's a number of times when I run into problems with that. Not often, certainly. And if you're just using it with, you know, browsing the web and stuff like that, you'll be fine with any CPU pretty much. And that's
They're doing in mobile CPUs, man. It's big time. I mean, this 15-inch MacBook Pro people think of, oh, well, a home computer should be a desktop machine, right? Well, no, I say no. I have, other than buying a machine that's going to be specific for a task, like when I have an in-studio, I have somebody in there working, doing editing, doing administrative work, that kind of thing, producing work. Yeah, then maybe, but maybe not. Maybe that'll be a portable machine too. I think portable machines in 2011, that's just the way to go. I can see getting a desktop machine for a specific function, but even for the house, I mean, I would rather spend the extra dough and get, or in this case, use the portable machine that I have. So now this begs the question. You have the 13. Most of the people that I know have the MacBook Air 13-inch. There's two outliers of all of the people in my Mac circle who are geeky enough to have really thought this through and have answers, as opposed to the person who, like, well, I went to the store, I liked it, I just bought it. Jason Snell, John Gruber, both have the 11-inch. Both prefer the 11-inch. Now, there's one other guy I can think of, the guy who runs Mac Mini Colo.net, where I have a machine hosted too. He has the 11 and prefers the 11. Now, you and most, the strong majority of everybody else that I know has the 13-inch MacBook Air. Why did you go 13?
All right, let me preface this with two things. One's a very quick thing. If you think our show is too long, you should really stop listening to this episode right now. We won't take offense because I'm about to ramble for a little bit.
Right. And we just, okay. I think we just hit the 60-minute, yeah, we just hit the 60-minute mark. So if you say it's an hour, you know what? You've heard the meat of the show. You've heard the two sponsors. You just want to hang out with me and Marco and talk about some geeky stuff. So fine. Yeah. If you're done, we're not going to have, well, actually, you know, I don't want to say there's no value here, but we're not going to have any big announcements. Like, you're not going to announce some secret API call you discovered or something like geeky.
No.
Like we're just talking about
this. This is all going to be talking about different models of Macs and arguing about them for a little while.
Just two guys hanging out talking about Macs.
So if you're done with the developer stuff, feel free to stop now. That's disclaimer number one. Disclaimer number two is going to be a little bit longer. So I've always kind of had this battle in my head, the grass is always greener syndrome, between two pairs of options, between one computer and multiple computers, and within the laptop world, between the 15-inch class of laptops and the smaller class, which I kind of lumped together as just smaller than the 15-inch. So
right.
That's when you make compromises in performance and versatility to gain better portability and other things like that, like, you know, lighter weight, smaller size for the most part. So those two battles, I'm still not settled on which one of either of those choices I like best. Currently, I have a Mac Pro and a 13-inch Air. And during the lifetime of having this Mac Pro as my primary computer, I have had a 15-inch MacBook Pro and both Airs, the first one and the most recent one. And the 15-inch MacBook Pro I still own. It's now my wife's computer for photo editing when she's traveling. I always, whichever setup I currently have, I'm always a little bit discontented with it. Is that the right use of that word?
I believe so.
Because they all have drawbacks. There's no setup is perfect. And so my current, currently I have a couple of complaints with Mac Pro plus 13-inch MacBook Air. One is that the Air is slow. But it's only slow in CPU speed and only when doing something that stresses the CPUs, like Xcode. It's really not a problem very often. Overall, it's a fantastic computer. I really have very few other complaints about it. The other problem, though, is that it's not my primary computer. So when I have the Air, I don't have my files and my apps for the most part. I have some of them with Dropbox and with, you know, things like that, but I don't have all my stuff. And so I can't just like pick up my laptop and resume work on anything.
Right.
I can kind of approximate that sometimes. Like I use version control so I can check out the stuff on my laptop and work on it and commit, make changes and stuff like that. But because it's not my primary computer, there's always going to be things it doesn't have on it. And so whenever I go traveling, I'm missing some stuff. I'm missing a lot of stuff, actually. And I have to keep it up to date. And it also just feels incredibly wasteful to have a laptop that I hardly ever use. Because now that I work, like when I was going to the city every day for work, I would bring a laptop with me and work on the train every day for 45 minutes each way.
Right.
That was awesome. Now that I work at home, I hardly ever use a laptop. I really only use it when traveling. And even then, I don't even use it that much while traveling. I more often will just use an iPad and read stuff because I realize I probably won't get a lot of work done in most travel situations.
Mm.
So it feels wasteful for me to have a laptop, to maintain a laptop, to, you know, upgrade its RAM and get the nice hard drives in it and everything, and a desktop, when I hardly ever use the laptop at all. But when I do use it, I push its limits, so it has to be pretty good. So I think for me, you know, and this could just be grass is always greener syndrome, I think my next computer, as I've discussed before, is going to probably be a 15-inch MacBook Pro. Because I travel so infrequently that, or rather, I use a laptop so infrequently that the lack of portability compared to an Air, which, by the way, I don't think is that different.
Right.
We'll talk about that in a second. But the lack of the difference in portability and weight and size and everything is not going to be a problem for me very often, and it's not going to be a major problem really ever. So there's that, and then if you're going to have a laptop be your primary computer, I think the 15-inch is the way to go because it just has so it's not only is it a lot faster than the Airs. And I think the 13-inch MacBook Pro, which is kind of the weird middle child here.
Yeah, like the bizarre stepchild. Stepchild, maybe.
Haven't raised the screen resolution on that.
No, they haven't. There's not even an option. Yeah.
That is a much worse computer to get than the 13-inch Air for most reasons. I don't know why people would still buy it. I mean, it's a little bit cheaper, but not by much.
And as you pointed out when I was shopping for this 15-inch, which, by the way, that's true too. But you pointed out when I was shopping that the weight difference between the 13-inch MacBook Pro and 15-inch MacBook Pro, there is one, but it's negligible. It's really not a big deal.
It's big. I think it's a full pound now.
Is it really?
I think it's 4.5 and 5.5.
If you go with the high res anti glare screen though, that gets it a little less.
Yeah, actually that's true. Yeah, if you put the anti glare on the 15-inch, it drops the weight by a little bit, and so that would make the difference smaller.
But I love this 15-inch MacBook Pro. I can say this: I haven't owned every Mac since 1984, but I've owned a lot of them, dozens of them. This is the best Mac I've ever owned or used. The MacBook Pro 15-inch. The best, just all around, just from fit and finish and fit, physical details to how snappy it is. We're recording this show on it right now. I've been recording all of the shows that anybody's heard for the last 6 weeks or more have all been recorded on this, edited. It's great for everything. And that's another reason that I need to have a machine like this at the house and couldn't use a MacBook Air is because it has FireWire and I have a little mini mixer. And that mini mixer is, it's not that small. It's still kind of big, but that's going to be at the house so that if I need to record from home, I'll always have that option. And I'll always need a machine like this there to do that. But, I'm thinking that maybe one of these 13 or 11-inch Airs, that if what I'm really using it for, and arguably it gets kind of close to what people would use an iPad for. There's a lot of people if they're still here, are thinking, well, Dan, you could just do all the stuff you're talking about, you could do with an iPad. And you know what? For the most part, they're right. They're right. But I'm one of those people that I still love and plan to do a heck of a lot of typing. And I have had an iPad since the day they came out, and I've had an iPad 2 since the day that those came out. And I type on it, but I just still really like the computer interaction model for a lot of the work that I do.
Yeah, me too. I totally agree. The iPad is awesome for a subset of things that we do. Like, have we said the microwave thing here?
I don't think we have.
I read this, or somebody said it or reread it somewhere. Sorry for whoever I'm ripping off here. I forgot. But it's like the iPad is like a microwave and computers like ovens. Like when microwaves first came out, no one really knew what to do with them yet. And people tried like cooking like whole turkeys in them and like right. cooking like they tried cooking everything in a microwave, and it really sucked at a lot of it. You know, obviously, like, you know, microwaves are really great at some things and pretty terrible at others. And it took a while for people to realize that what they were good at and what they should be used for versus other things, and B, that it was okay that they weren't good at everything. People had to come. They had to realize, you know, this is not going to replace my oven, even though it's a big investment. It's another thing we have to have, but and it's not going to replace the oven. But it's still great, and it's better than the oven at a certain set of things, and therefore it's worth having. I think a lot of people have to come to that with, with the iPad. It's is it TechCrunch? Oh no, TechInch. Good. Jay Thrash in the chat just posted the link. I thought it was TechCrunch. I was going to be really sad. There. Yeah. Okay. I'll link this in the show notes. So the iPad is not a laptop replacement. Some people will be okay having just an iPad. In fact, I actually just bought one for my grandpa. He's thrilled. Some people will be okay with that. A lot of people could be okay with just that. Just like a lot of people never use their oven, they're fine with a microwave and having only a microwave. But I think most people who are using computing often and who are doing a variety of things with computing are probably going to want a computer. Maybe also an iPad, maybe no iPad, but they're probably going to want a computer, like a personal computer. Keyboard, etc.
Right. Plug in some hard drives.
I love your voices. So
use a mouse.
So yeah, so I don't think that there's really any shame or that we should be placing any doubt on ourselves to right. try to go iPad only for our portable needs. Because I think both of us are well within the camp of needing a personal computer for a lot of the work that we do.
But here's the thing, why the 13 then? If I have a machine at home that's a it's got a lot of horsepower, obviously it can do a lot of great things. It's going to do just fine at home. Don't even need, it's got a 15-inch screen. Don't even need to have a monitor on any of the desks at home. Don't need to have any room set up specific. I want to sit in the living room, use it. Want to sit in the study, have it. Want to sit over here, great. Back patio, super. Grilling something, great. Fine. That's the home machine, can be used by multiple people, super. Then you get into this, well, now I'm committed now. I'm getting one of these machines. This is 11 or 13. I'm going to bring this thing around. Again, at the studio, I don't need anything super powerful there. We've got Mac Pros. We've got all these high-end machines. They're going to do whatever they're going to do. I just need something that I can do the basics with. And for me, those basics mean, email, browsing, maybe some, I might have to do a deploy from there once in a while. I might want to make a change while I'm sitting there and say, I'm going to deploy some code from here. So there's a legitimate use for the laptop. We identified that already. Why go with the 13 then? Why not go to the 11, assuming that they do a little bit of a CPU bump, which I don't even know that I'd need that. Why go 13 instead of 11?
Well, first let me point out, the difference between 13 and 11 is a pretty big difference in a lot of different factors. It's not a small difference. The 11 is a lot smaller, footprint-wise. Thickness, I think it's about the same, but it's a much smaller footprint. The screen resolution is much smaller. The screen lid is much smaller. So on an airplane tray table, that makes a big difference. If you have a problem where you sit in coach seats on airplanes and people in front of you lean back and you're trying to use your laptop when the person in front of you is fully reclined because they're an idiot. Not an idiot. They're just rude. But
yeah, they might be very.
I never recline my seat all the way for that reason.
They might be very smart, but they're very rude. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it does everyone a great service if you don't recline your seats all the way, if even at all, because you don't need to. Anyway, so if you have, if you're often using it on a tray table, on an airplane, in coach, with somebody in front of you who isn't very considerate, the 11 is probably the only one you can reasonably use often in that situation. The question, though, is whether you find yourself in that situation often enough to justify the limitations of it. Now, really, the screen is very, very small, resolution-wise. I believe is it 1280 by 768? It's something like that. And 1280 across is not unheard of small. That was the resolution of the old Air and every 13-inch laptop Apple's made in the last couple of years. But 768 down is really short.
Yeah, it's very short.
And if it is set with somebody, chat room, can you look that up for me?
Now, is that the same? Note. Is it the same resolution?
Oh, okay, no, it's 1366 by 768.
Thanks, is it the same, Marco, the same resolution, essentially the same like dots per inch pixel size that the 15-inch high res is going to have, or is it even smaller than that?
I think it's actually more dense than that.
No kidding.
I'll have to do the math. I don't know for sure, but I think it's even more dense, but by a little bit. It's certainly in the ballpark. So anyway, the width is okay. That's, you can get away with the width. The height is really, really short. So like Apple hasn't made a laptop with that little height since I think the 12-inch PowerBook. It's been a while. So that's really, really tight.
Yeah.
Modern software and modern web pages are not going to be comfortable in a lot of situations on a screen that's only 768 tall. And also the 11, in addition to having the much smaller screen, it has a significantly slower CPU today. We'll see what happens, you know, with the next one. But today it has significantly slower CPU options and significantly less battery life, which is a big deal, and significantly smaller hard drive options. The options are cut in half, basically. You have 64 or 128 gigs available to you. There are some aftermarket things, but it's up to you whether you want to deal with that or not. I probably wouldn't. So in that case, in the 15-inch, sure, but in the Air, I really wouldn't want to install an aftermarket thing because it's just so tight in there. It's really not made for serviceability. So the 11 is a major, major step down in a number of these factors. It's a huge step up in portability. All this is a long-winded way of saying there's a big difference between the 13 and the 11. It's not a small difference. So it's up to you, you know, what your priorities are, what your situation is going to be with when you want to use this. In the case of Jason Snell, I don't know how he's using it. I think John Gruber is using it mostly while traveling.
Yeah, I think so too.
That's not his primary computer. So he has an iMac, right? So
I think he actually has a MacBook Pro that's essentially full time docked, right?
Okay, I thought he upgraded to an iMac.
Maybe
anyway,
he did. I'll have to ask him.
He has the same situation as me, as far as I know, because he works at home and is at his desktop most of the time, and so the laptop is really for travel and possibly around the house use, but probably mostly for travel. So he's not using it a lot, and like not using it often, probably, because that's how I use mine. I don't use it often. And so in that kind of situation, that's probably fine for that. Jason Snell, I don't know how he's using it. I'd love to hear from him to illustrate us or to fill us in on this.
Yeah. Well, this is great food for thought for me. During the course of the show, actually just within the last few minutes, I have been sent a secret communication from a little birdie. And a little birdie told me that they were hearing the 12th for the MacBook
Steve, Air. Right?
It is not Steve. He has never.
I know he calls you to talk.
No, I wish, but I'm still waiting. Still waiting. Hold on, was that the phone?
He should send up a Google search.
the little birdie says the 12th.
Okay, so that's what, like a week from today?
A week from today. So what that means is that the next time that we do this show, I will have ordered something, if that's the case. Maybe.
So the question is, so between 15-inch and smaller, I will go on the record and say there's almost no reason why anybody should buy the 13-inch MacBook Pro. So I'm not even considering that as an option.
Yeah, that's out. That's out.
And the plastic book as well, I think, is with that.
Yeah, that's out.
It's a very good,
that's like, good for kids.
Value solution, but kids. For the kind of use you're going to do, it's not. That's out. So looking at only between the two Airs and the 15-inch, as we know them today, and as we expect, you know, I would assume that there's not going to be any other major changes to the Air. I'm thinking faster CPUs and Thunderbolt. And the SSD thing is probably not going to make a meaningful difference.
Yeah.
If they use faster SSDs, it's not. They're already really fast. So
that's just Apple getting whatever the best technology is and putting it in their machines. That's not even really a big deal.
New CPU, new motherboard chipset with Thunderbolt, and that sort of stuff. So it's going to be mostly same thing but faster, I think is a pretty reasonable way to look at it. It's probably not going to be massively, you know, it's probably going to be the exact same case, same weight, you know, same shape, all that stuff. Probably the same price range as well. So anyway, assuming all that, you can probably rule out a 15-inch laptop for this use, because it sounds like the primary use of this is to be portable. You're not going to be necessarily doing lots of strenuous work on it.
Right, right.
And screen space is probably not going to be at a massive premium here. Is that safe to say?
That's right. It's between the 13 and the 11.
Okay, so for those things, how about battery life? Is that going to be important? Because the 11 really does have a lot less battery life.
See, that was something you mentioned to me in chat and that you hadn't mentioned here. Yeah, and you're saying that the 13 has a much better battery.
It's something like 40% more. I don't know the numbers offhand. It's a big difference though, because it's one of the ways they shaved down the space in the 11 is they cut out lots of the battery area. Right. So it's
okay. You know what? I'm done. I'm done. 13. I'm done.
Yeah. And the thing is, decision. Too, and I should mention this. We are like bending over. We as an industry collectively, not me and you, of course, we're smart. But we as a geek society here, looking at Mac laptops, are like bending over backwards to try to save like 1 pound and 2 inches of footprint. In most situations, that doesn't really matter. Like right. As you're using it, when it's sitting on your lap, it doesn't matter. When it's sitting on a table, it doesn't matter. When it's sitting on a desk, it doesn't matter. What matters is when you put it in a bag and when you have to use it in a very cramped space like an airplane tray table. On a tray table, I will not even try to argue that anything but the 11 is usable because it's not. If the person in front of you is not leaning back or leaning back only an inch or two, then you can use any of them. You can use a 17 if you wanted to, the aircraft carrier. But you know, if they're going to lean back and give you very little space, you're pretty much stuck with 11 or iPad at that point. And by the way, I think iPad is a better idea for most people unless you need to get a lot of work done there. So there's that. When you're carrying it in a bag, and I've talked about this before here, I think, in a bag, there's really not that much difference because your whole bag weighs something. And your whole bag might weigh like, you know, take the laptop out. Put the power brick in because you're going to carry a power brick, right?
Well, I'm going to have one in both places, so I'm not going to have to carry one of those.
Okay, so the battery life's important to you then.
That's right. That's
why the 13. You end up at a coffee shop unexpectedly for 6 hours.
13.
Right, so, but back to the regular point. Well, I guess that is back to my off topic rant. The fact is, when you're carrying a computer in a bag, whether that computer is 2.2 pounds or 2.9 pounds, which is the 11 and 13 inch Airs, you are really not going to notice that difference in all likelihood, because the bag weighs something. If you have anything else in the bag, that weighs something. If you are carrying the power brick to the laptop with you, that weighs something. And so the relative difference is not that big. Even then, when you move up to the big ones, the 15 inches, big in air quotes again, that's 5.5 pounds roughly, minus the power, or plus the power brick. Even that, the difference between the 13 inch Air at 3 pounds and the 15 inch at 5.5, that's 2.5 pounds. That's, you're probably carrying 2.5 pounds of unnecessary crap with you in that bag, in all likelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on what kind of bag it is, like if it's a backpack, you won't even notice the difference. If it's a shoulder bag, you might. I'll give you that. But for the most part, most people carry around so much crap in their bags anyway that you know your whole bag might weigh 10 pounds or might weigh 15 pounds. You know, it gets up there pretty quickly. And so you know, we nitpick on all these different size classes and say, oh, I'm willing to make all these compromises to save this 1 pound or this 0.5 pound.
Right.
But in the grand scheme of things, you might not even notice that 0.5 pound savings in most of your usage. And so you made all those compromises kind of for nothing. So that's why I'm a big fan of the 15-inch laptop class. And I think the 13-inch Air is a really good machine. The 11-inch is a very specialized machine. It makes a lot of compromises to achieve an extreme in portability. But it's an extreme that a lot of people really don't need. And then they've therefore compromised for kind of for nothing. So you're sold on the 13 then?
I'm sold on the 13.
All right.
Thanks to you. And if it sucks, it's your fault.
Okay.
But we won't know. But I appreciate that. Well, thanks, Marco. So we will be back next week. And if these things and Lion are all announced or start going up for sale or being sold, then we'll definitely talk about it on Tuesday next week.
All right. See you then.
So thanks again to everybody who tuned in. Really appreciate it. We want to remind you that we have lots of great shows over on 5x5.tv. If you enjoy them, you can, of course, please go to iTunes and rate the shows. Helps new people find out about them. It helps the iTunes people know that you like them. And that's very important to us. So thanks again for doing that. Thanks to everybody who went to 5x5.tv/donate and donated. It makes a big, big, big difference. And we love you for it. And we love you even if you don't donate. We also love our sponsors, MailChimp.com and Sound Studio 4, available from the Mac App Store and Feltip.com. We'll see you all again next week.